Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. I want to open with a quote. Here we go. "I have little or no faith in the American Christian civilization's methods of healing the Indians of this country. It has not been honest, pure, or sincere. Black deception, damnable frauds, and persistent oppression have been its characteristics, and its religion today is that the only good Indian is a dead one." No, this is not from a manifesto of the American Indian movement. This is Ellie Parker, the 19th century Tonawanda Seneca, who for a few short years after the Civil War served as the first indigenous commissioner of Indian affairs. Yes, this is a top federal official labeling the U.S. government, his former employer, the purveyor of black deception, damnable frauds, and persistent oppression. Granted, Ellie Parker wrote these words over a decade after being maneuvered out of office by forces of racism and dispossession, the so-called Friends of the Indians, who came to dominate policy in the late 19th century. But that a character like Ellie Parker even served as commissioner hints at the possibilities of the Reconstruction era, what Eric Foner called America's unfinished revolution. Today, I'm thrilled to say I'll be joined by Joseph Jenatin Palawa, author of Crooked Path to Allotment, The Fight Over Federal Indian Policy After the Civil War, just out from the University of North Carolina Press and the First Peoples Publishing Initiative. As Jenatin Palawa masterfully relates, the 19th century was not one long, inexorable march toward dispossession. Such a story, even when told with all tragic gravity, is just too simple. Letting the colonizers off the hook for impulses they could not control nor reflect upon. Yet figures like Parker, Thomas Bland, and others developed, debated, and agitated for viable policy alternatives to allotment and forced assimilation, even winning some key battles while losing the war. Their struggle is essential to reckon with. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Joseph Jenatin Palawa, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you.
Sure. So I've been a big fan of yours personally ever since you introduced yourself at the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association conference in June and said that you were a regular listener. But now I'm happy to report I'm also a big fan of yours intellectually after the publication of this new book. Because, it would have been awkward if the book wasn't as awesome as it was. But it is. It's called Crooked Paths to Allotment, The Fight Over Federal Indian Policy After the Civil War. It's just released from the University of North Carolina Press and the First Peoples Publishing Initiative. And before we dive into the rich material here, I want, of course, to first ask you to introduce yourself and then talk a bit about how you came to write this particular book. What drew you to Native history more broadly and these stories in particular?
Yeah, well, so thank you for all of the kind words. I don't know if anybody's ever described themselves as a personal fan of mine in such a way, but I really, really appreciate that. And I appreciate the kind words that you said about the book. I'm currently an assistant professor of history at Illinois College. I received my PhD in 2008 from Michigan State University, where I worked with Susan Sleeper Smith and Maureen Flanagan, among others. So I became interested in, I've always been interested in law and policy and politics. Originally, when I went to college, I envisioned going on to law school. But along the way, I had some really incredible history professors, including a man named Ed Danziger, who took his undergraduate classes to visit the Walpole Island First Nations community in Ontario. And that was a transformative experience for me. I ended up going back to Walpole many times, spending time in the Heritage Center, studying, taking Anishinaabe Mohin classes. And it was at Walpole where I think I began to understand the connection, the living legacy of the history of this continent. And the indigenous history of this continent in a way that I hadn't understood it before. That really brought it home for me. And I think that was what inspired me to move forward in indigenous studies and native history. More specifically for this book, I actually envisioned writing a book about allotment. In particular, writing a book about the National Indian Defense Association, an organization that challenged the Friends of the Indian, challenged Henry Dawes, and the other advocates of dispossession and coercive assimilation. Ultimately, those individuals in that organization make up a part of the book, but as I think often happens when we study history in these ways, I started asking questions about where did the ideas that formed the foundation of the National Indian Defense Association's platform come from? Who had talked about these things previously? And so I started questioning and looking back in time. And that brought me to the peace policy era and the era immediately following the Civil War. And so ultimately what I envisioned being a book that would have been set primarily in the late 19th and early 20th century became a book about the mid 19th century.
It's interesting because, you know, allotment is not the first choice you would think, given that it's well-tread academic terrain. But this is not the book about allotment we usually see, certainly not the one we see in history surveys or mainstream textbooks. You write instead about paths not taken, moments that reveal alternative possibilities that existed in the development of U.S. colonialism or what might have been, moments in which power was questioned, policies debated, and uncontested progress, well contested. Why is this a story you wanted to tell? And did you go into it thinking you might find these alternatives, or were you surprised by them?
The language of alternatives came later. I think initially it was a much more organic thing. I was reading this older, as you say, well-established literature, well-tread ground on allotment, and I kept running up against some conceptual constructions, essentially, that seemed to pervade the literature. So the idea that to be, quote, to be pro-Indian was to be pro-assimilation and pro-allotment. That's something that pervades that literature.
The Friends of the Indian, right?
The Friends of the Indian. Or if there was any debate at all, it was between the military and military strategy and humanitarian strategy. But on some level, I was running across in my research and just in my graduate study more generally, indigenous leaders who were obviously arguing strongly against allotment and against continued dispossession and against coercive assimilation, and I started to question that there had to be others. There had to be individuals who were actually within the mainstream systems of governance. People who were working within the federal government who questioned these directions. It didn't seem to me possible that everybody thought this was a good idea. And that was what led me first to Thomas Bland and then later to Ely Parker. Obviously, somebody like Collier is an interesting and controversial character who fits into this framework in some ways, although I think that I felt less comfortable dealing with him in great depth, which is why he appears in the epilogue of the book as opposed to a section of all of his own. But really, you know, finding individuals like Bland and then starting to read Parker's writings, not what has been written about Parker, which I take issue with a lot of it, but rather reading Parker's own writings. That was kind of what pushed me into thinking about paths not taken, finding coalitions building around alternative ideas. It was an eye-opening experience, and I thought that was the story that hadn't been told in that literature.
Right, because you would also, you know, if I were to say, you know, I'm writing a book about resistance to allotment, I think what would come to mind would be martial resistance, you know, fighting the cavalry on the field, you know, the resistance of the so-called Indian Wars. But instead, you're interested in politics going on in Washington, I mean, and elsewhere as well, but, you know, you're featuring what you call genuine or viable alternatives to coercive assimilation and dispossession, though you don't obviously imply that the martial resistance going on in the West was out of place necessarily. But how are you defining genuine or viable here?
Yeah, so that's a term that comes from a body of thought in political science, American political development. And the idea is for something to be a viable alternative, it has to, in a sense, have legs. It has to have support. There are all sorts of ideas that emerge in these sorts of political debates that are stillborn or that are otherwise not exactly viable. For me, a viable alternative has to have support within mainstream structures of governance, and those the ideas that I talk about during the Reconstruction era, and then again in the later 19th century that Ely Parker and Thomas Bland championed, I think fit that description. There were significant policymakers, activists, and others who supported these ideas. These were not eccentric outliers. These were viable ideas that were actively then repressed.
You take another, develop another term from that political science literature. It's a political entrepreneur. You know, when I read that, I'm thinking of Karl Rove, but that's, I'm sure that's not what you had in mind. It's just the election season is upon us. What do you mean by a political entrepreneur?
Right. Yeah. So this is an idea, again, that comes out of American political development and comes out of political science, of an individual who seeks to consolidate power around themselves, but really operates in much the way that we might understand an economic entrepreneur to act, right? Who will act individually, but works to strategize and seize moments of opportunity. Essentially, works to frame issues and develop agendas that can transform policies or institutions. Oftentimes, these individuals do not have immediate success, and I think that's also why somebody like Parker or Bland sort of fits this description. These men lost most of the battles they fought in their lives, but ultimately, I think that their ideas continue on beyond their own lives. You know, particularly their opposition to coercive assimilation and dispossession, and their support for issues related to sovereignty.
And I want to return to both these characters and get you to introduce them a bit more formally a little bit later. But as you've mentioned, those are ideas that you're drawing from a literature on American political development, but you're also situating this book in the context of post-colonialism and studies on settler colonialism. I'm not terribly familiar with American political development, but I would imagine that not many in the field place the development of American politics and statecraft in the context of ongoing settler colonialism, that see that as the structure of American politics. Why did you merge these frameworks for this study? And more importantly, why can't you separate American political development from the broader processes of colonialism when you're talking about American Indian history?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that there's some really interesting work that's being done. By no means am I the first person to look to these two particular bodies of theory and bodies of thought in American political development and post-colonial critique and post-colonial scholarship. Kevin Brenneel is one who comes to mind, who's incredibly influential in my conceptualization. Jackie Rand's work fits in here as well. I think it seems odd at first, and I think that I lay this out in the book, that American political development does tend to think east to west. It has an east to west orientation where post-colonialism or settler colonial studies in North America tends to think west to east. But I think that the larger idea is that colonial rule, that settler colonialism and American democracy were not mutually exclusive, and in fact may have been, and as these individuals and I argue, were mutually constitutive. Hmm. Brendan Lindsay's another one who maybe not so overtly, but talks in these terms.
Hmm. So in tracing the backstory to the political debates that are really the centerpiece of the work, the key concept you talk about is confinement. And I think even, and if I'm not mistaken, that was the original title of your dissertation, right? Was Confining Indians.
Yes.
So I think even folks with a basic knowledge of Indian history would be familiar with confinement in space and territory, reservations, prisoners of war camps, etc. But you and people like Kevin Brenneel also raised the concept of confinement in time and confinement in law. What do you mean here? Why is that an important concept for you in the backstory to these debates going on in the 1870s and 80s?
Yeah, so I think that for me, so oftentimes when you hear people using a spatially based term, oftentimes you hear containment. Containment is the term that is often used. I think for me, confinement is a broader term. It encompasses more, as you say, and I think that for someone who's trying to understand late 19th century reformers, it's important to grasp the development of the 19th century, the development of Indian affairs across the 19th century. And again, I'm thinking about this from the perspective of policy and law. The existing literature defines this almost as a linear mm-hmm. pathway from removal through reservation policies and the development of reservation policies and ultimately to allotment, essentially a linear path with, mm-hmm. with little derivation, very, very little discussion. And there's a tone of inevitability to it. Mm-hmm. I think that thinking in those terms, I think, flattens a lot of the complexity of these eras. And that's really what I'm trying to do when I talk about confinement in time and politics and the law as well. It's important to think about the ways in which sovereignty as a legal concept changes throughout the 19th century and the ways in which a settler colonial government employs a fluid definition of sovereignty as a weapon. Mm. So I think that that's particularly significant. I think also, though, it's important to think about the limits of confinement. And this is something that you're familiar with in the work that you do as well, as much as we might think about confinement and dispossession and assimilation as limiting processes, they were also limited processes. And that there was space and there were opportunities for indigenous leaders and others to operate. These moments are particularly interesting. They're rupture points. They're disjunctures. I think I use the term constitutive moment. Mm. Right? moment when a previously what was previously sort of status quo no longer was status quo, when individuals questioned policies and ideas. So I think that it's important to also consider the limits of confinement.
Hmm. So one place that you explore that in the first section of the book, or I guess the second chapter, but before we get into the debates around Indian policy in the post-Civil War period, is the removal crisis at Tonawanda, one of the Seneca reservations in western New York. Again, it's not a removal crisis that I think most people would be familiar with. They think of the Southeast, the Cherokees, the Creeks, the Trail of Tears. But you draw our attention here to another, ultimately unsuccessful attempt, or a not fully successful attempt to ethnically cleanse, to remove Senecas from western New York. And this is a fight where Ellie Parker, who is a central character here, really gets his chops in navigating federal and state policy and learning how to develop viable alternatives. Tell us a bit about the fight against removal in Tonawanda. I know it's a big story and you could kind of start anywhere, but I guess I'm curious about it as a testing ground or a training ground for Ellie Parker.
Yeah, and that gets right to the heart of the issue, actually. So I focus on the removal effort and the fight against removal as a political education for Ellie Parker, which he would then use later, his experiences in Western New York, in his homeland, on the broader national stage. And so there's an incredibly fraudulent treaty, the Treaty of Buffalo Creek in 1838, that sets off a period of a removal effort by the Ogden Land Company. Parker is a very young man when this treaty is signed. We most believe that he was born around 1828. So it's not until he's about 16 years old that he gets involved. He is fluent in both English and Haudenosaunee, and is able to serve as an interpreter first for Seneca leaders in Albany and Washington, D.C., those who are protesting the treaty and protesting the Ogden Company's efforts to remove the Tonawanda. The political consequences in Western New York of this removal crisis for Seneca people is significant. And several people have written about this, Lawrence Hauptman among them, and others. But it is reflective of the larger removal efforts in the Southeast, in that the state government, the federal government, and the private company, the Ogden Land Company, are all involved, and they all employ essentially a divide and conquer strategy, exploiting divisions and factionalism wherever it exists. Parker serves first as an interpreter, but then later, as he becomes a young adult, starts speaking in his own right. There's a lot of behind the scenes things going on as well. Clan matrons and others are working behind the scenes, but Parker becomes a spokesperson, essentially, who was a very young man, a 17, 18-year-old man, is traveling sometimes on his own to Washington to meet with congressmen and others. From Parker's perspective, he learns some interesting things during this land dispute, removal effort. One of them is unique, I think, to the Western New York state and environment and history of landholding there. Local white settlers in the 1840s and early 1850s sign many petitions and memorials on behalf of the Seneca. There's a larger history of Eastern New York state land companies owning large chunks of the Western parts of the state, again, fraudulently and incredibly fraudulently. But local white farmers, local settlers, see the Seneca as rightful owners of this land, and band with them. This sets Parker up to imagine cooperation and collaboration, I think, in ways that later in the 19th century, when he's focused, when he's working to develop policy that's going to affect the, you know, the west of the Mississippi, the Great Plains, and others, where he's not going to experience the same kind of collaboration. The settlers there are going to certainly be different than the Western New York State.
As they were in the Southeast, I mean, the idea of a Georgia settler signing a petition to protect Cherokee land and what became Western Georgia wouldn't happen. And yet you find this surprising coalition going on in upstate New York. I found that totally fascinating and surprising. I really did not expect that.
Well, and so I don't want to take that too far, though. I mean, you know, the Seneca are leading this campaign, but they do get this unlikely support, as you say. And it's important, and I think it's important because it does set Parker up, I think, to perhaps misunderstand or expect something to happen later that doesn't happen when he starts to work on the federal level. But he comes up, he's a condoled chief, and is in 1851, he ultimately ends up working for, first where he works in the Erie Canal, he studies law, he wants to practice law, but is, denied access to the New York State Bar. He works, as I said, on the Erie Canal, ends up working for the U.S. Treasury Department as a civil engineer, building customs houses, spends time in Virginia, Michigan, Illinois, where he meets U.S. Grant following the Mexican War, continues to advocate on behalf of the Seneca, going back to Washington, D.C. at various points. Ultimately, in 1857, helping to negotiate a deal in which the Seneca were able to use some of the money that was set aside for removal to actually purchase back from the Ogden Land Company their own homelands, which is, in some ways, I think a tragic story, obviously. In other ways, it's a different story than we would see, as you said, in the Southeast. The Seneca remain, the Tonawanda remain in their homelands, or at least partially, and that's in large part the result of this fight.
Mm-hmm. He's also becomes connected to Lewis Henry Morgan during this fight, right? I mean, this is the father of modern anthropology. I know you don't, you know, that's not a huge relationship for you in this story, but you do call their relationship symbiotic in a way. It's interesting that he's also developing this connection to someone like Morgan.
Yeah, you know, actually, in an earlier version, an earlier draft of this manuscript, I spend a lot more time talking about the Parker and Morgan relationship. Mm-hmm. Many people have written about this. And it is an interesting relationship, but, you know, Parker becomes, in a lot of ways, Morgan's first and most important informant early on. You know, there's even some discussion as to, you know, how much of some of Morgan's early work did maybe Parker actually write.
Mm.
I think that it is symbiotic in the sense that Morgan helps Parker and the Seneca to mobilize some of those white settlers during the Buffalo Creek treaty period. So there's the farmers and settlers, the who signed the petitions and memorials, but there's also a group of sort of intellectuals and lawyers, non-native intellectuals and lawyers who get involved on the behalf of the Seneca. And Morgan helps to mobilize some of that.
Mm. I imagine probably there are some that are motivated by romanticized notions, I would imagine, or at least, you know, someone like Morgan and what Phil DeLoria has written about him. But it's interesting that Parker could use that to his advantage in some of these fights. You know?
And this goes back to Parker, I think, being a political entrepreneur. And I could have, I think, perhaps brought that out even more than I do in the book. You're absolutely right. And in fact, in some of the most interesting of Ely Parker's writings from this time period in his life, he's almost, I want to say that he's making fun of Morgan in some of his letters and some of his diary entries. He talks about Morgan and others trying to cross a stream, for example, and falling into it. And he talks about how, you know, for these members of this, you know, society of I'm blanking on the name of Morgan's.
I can't remember the league. No, it's not the league. It's the order or something. It's a fraternity. It's almost like a Masonic organization in a way.
Actually, but filled with this romanticized Indian imagery, right? They practice these in Indianation ceremonies,
right?
Where they literally come to embody deceased Haudenosaunee warriors and things like that. Parker actually provided some of the vocabulary that they use in those ceremonies. And then in letters to his brother, he makes fun of them.
Fascinating. So Parker ends up in Washington. After his removal fight and his Civil War service, and he's a close aide of Ulysses S. Grant. You actually see him briefly in Spielberg's Lincoln. I wish he had a speaking role, but he at least is there. But after the Civil War, he ascends the ranks of federal Indian policy at a very unique historical moment, Reconstruction, or America's unfinished revolution, as Foner would have it. So why is this moment so fruitful and important for building the viable alternatives to confinement and dispossession that Parker articulates in his reign as the first and only, until much later, indigenous commissioner of Indian affairs?
Yeah, so let me pick up with Parker. I mentioned that he meets Grant and becomes friends with Grant in Illinois. When the Civil War begins, Parker petitions in New York State for a commission. And he's denied that commission. He gets in touch with Grant, and Grant ultimately brings him in. So he serves from Vicksburg through the end of the war with Grant. After the war ends, he stays on. He's mustered out of the military as a brigadier general, but stays on as Grant's aide-de-camp and essentially his personal secretary. It's actually Parker who writes the surrender agreement at Appomattox Courthouse. The story goes that he was the only one whose hand was calm enough to actually use the quill and ink. After the war, he travels across the South with Grant, and then, as you say, works his way into the Office of Indian Affairs. It's something that he had wanted to do for a long time. His aspiration was to work in Indian Affairs on the national level. He becomes a peace commissioner for a number of important treaty commissions and peace councils in the West and South, which is, I think, really important in his own development from, you know, moving from Tonawanda to thinking more nationally. I think the bigger issue that you're asking about, though, is why Reconstruction? What is it about that moment? And it's a great question. Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of the Civil War, the individuals who had sacrificed so much wanted to believe that it was for something. Historian Hannah Rosen, Heather Cox Richardson, another historian, Mark Summers, have all written about the optimism of the immediate post-war era. They focus primarily, Richardson focuses on the West, the others focus on the South. This becomes a moment in which individuals are willing to try things that they had previously been unwilling to try. I think that Parker recognized that. I think that traveling around with Grant and his inner circle and working with radical Republicans in Congress, meeting these individuals, working with them, I think that he felt that this was a moment in which the larger trajectories of dispossession, course of assimilation could be questioned. Could be approached in some different ways. I don't want to suggest that Parker imagined westward expansion of the United States ending or something like that. He certainly didn't envision he certainly had a complicated view of separate sovereignties, but he believed that coercive assimilation and dispossession were dispossessions by any means necessary were incredibly problematic. He believed that indigenous homelands needed to be protected, they needed to be clarified in law, and that Native people needed to be given opportunities to assimilate or not of their own choice and on their own time frame too. He advocated slowing down this process and giving Native people an opportunity to choose to what extent they wanted to engage with settler society.
This obviously creates enemies in Eastern philanthropic circles, in elite policy circles. Who were Parker's enemies? Why did they circle around him? And were they successful?
Yeah, so Parker comes into the Office of Indian Affairs as commissioner. He's appointed in 68 after Grant's election and comes in 69. At the same time, the Board of Indian Commissioners is established, which is one of these elements of the peace policy. It's supposed to be a group of men who are eminent in their philanthropy, who will serve without any pay or anything, and essentially serve as an oversight committee, monitoring the purchase and distribution of annuity and treaty goods, which in theory seems like a good idea. The men who are selected, interestingly, all represent either or were involved in directly or indirectly transportation industries, extraction industries. They were involved in merchant and shipping industries. So they all represented business interests that would profit from continued dispossession and continued confinement on reservations. I think that these men become policy advocates in a way that maybe it wasn't envisioned that they would to begin with. One of these men, a man named William Welsh from Philadelphia, becomes his own backstory is he is an Episcopal layman, a philanthropist in the Philadelphia area, but comes to believe that educated Christian white men know what is better for Native communities than Native people do themselves, and works against many of the ideas that Parker and his activists, his reformers, are trying to establish in the early peace policy era.
So what's interesting and tragically ironic, of course, that you point out is that much of what Parker did accomplish before he's ousted in making bureaucracy more efficient actually facilitated the smoother functioning of dispossession when the policy ideas of William Welsh and others like him become supreme again after his tenure. It's sort of a tragic irony.
Right. Well, so just to be clear, the alternative policies that Parker's advocating it involves several things. First, he believed that the Office of Indian Affairs was corrupt and mismanaged, which I think most everybody believed in the 1850s and 60s and beyond into the 70s and 80s and, you know, and beyond. But he worked to make the Office of Indian Affairs run more efficiently. He advocated, actually, he was one of the advocates of what became known as the transfer debate, transferring the Office of Indian Affairs from the Interior Department, which is where it had been seated since the late 1840s. Initially, it had been in the War Department. He advocated transferring it back to the War Department. In much of the existing literature, the argument is made that that various proponents of this transfer did so because it would facilitate military action. I think that Parker's different from these other advocates. I think that Parker saw the War Department as the most developed bureaucratic agency in the federal government following the Civil War. The Civil War, of course, to carry out the Civil War, the North has to develop the War Department bureaucratically. It's a much, much bigger agency after the war than it was before. And it does many things very well during the war itself. I think that Parker understood that, particularly because he worked really less as a soldier and more as a military bureaucrat during the war. Hmm. When Parker advocates for the transfer, it's because he sees it as a way to help bureaucratize and make more efficient the Office of Indian Affairs. He also advocates what he describes as feeding versus fighting. He essentially argues that the treaties must be upheld to the absolute letter in which they're written, that the kinds of factors that led to the Dakota War in 1862, the starvation and the trauma and the horror going on in Dakota communities, and then later at the massacre at Sand Creek, really influenced Parker there. And so he argues that the military wouldn't need to take the kinds of actions that it did if Native communities were dealt with justly and honestly. As part of that, he also argues that that Native land ownership, that Indigenous land ownership, needed to be clarified legally, and that there needed to be additional support legally for Indigenous ownership. And what went along with that was the protection of sovereignty and sovereign rights. Finally, he saw oversight within the Office of Indian Affairs as a significant oversight with an organization like the Board of Indian Commissioners to be incredibly important. To make sure that the goods and services that were being provided via treaties were good, essentially, and that they were that there wasn't rotten food and other things being transported. So these were the things that he advocated for. And I've completely forgotten your question.
No, that's quite all right. I mean, it gets at how he made the office a more efficient bureaucracy along the lines of what he had seen in the military. But I guess my question was, when a different philosophy of Indian policy takes over from the office that he's helped make more efficient, that efficiency ends up facilitating very policies he finds anathema.
Right. Yeah. I think that that's exactly right. I think that that's one of, as you say, the tragic ironies of this moment. Parker does these things as an effort to slow down or stop dispossession, and to encourage others to reconsider the value of coercive assimilation. Parker believed that given educational opportunities, employment opportunities, and things like that, that Native people would do as he had done, which is, work through educational academies. He believed that Native people were fully capable of that, which is not true of many of his other contemporaries. Mm. And so I think that's what makes Parker really interesting in this moment. This, of course, though, in the 1870s becomes problematic for advocates of westward expansion. This is all premised on a much slower pace, a slower time frame, a time frame that's dictated by Indigenous communities themselves. And so advocates of westward expansion find this problematic. And I think that the Board of Indian Commissioners and William Welsh fit in there. But it does, I think, Parker's successes in cleaning up the Office of Indian Affairs in some ways. It's interesting because in his lifetime, Parker was accused of being in with the corrupt factions of the Indian Ring and things like that, that he was facilitating the corruption. Of course, I think that was part of the political tactics of his opponents to repress those alternatives that he was advocating. So But ultimately, allotment isn't possible without an incredibly well-developed bureaucracy. Phil DeLoria writes about this, that it's about being able to locate people in space and time. All the things that go along with that, the things like the Dawes roles, the renaming people, monitoring every single expenditure on a within an indigenous community, everything from the materials to build a shed or a barn to a hammer or a pair of shoes. That's only possible with an incredibly well developed bureaucratic structure, and it's during Parker's term, his short term as commissioner, that those things happen.
And so he eventually steps down. He's not actually convicted of any or found guilty of any of the accusations of corruption, but he's nonetheless he steps out of office in 1871, which is also a pretty dramatic year in the shifting of Indian policy. It's the year that Congress unilaterally ended the treaty making regime with indigenous nations. It's the moment that Kevin Bernil in his book talks about the shift to post-colonial time. Are these moments linked at all for you? I mean, are they coming out? They're coming out of the same Congress, obviously. Are they coming out of similar impulses? The desire to end treaty making and also get rid of someone like Parker who might propose viable alternatives?
I think that they are. Absolutely. These things aren't happening in a vacuum. I think that what's interesting, and so I want to take up a couple of separate but related issues here. One of the ways in which Parker has been written about that I find troubling is Parker advocated the end of treaty making as well. I think that in much of the existing literature, that's seen as a betrayal on Parker's part. If you read what Parker wrote about treaty making, I think that he conceptualized it differently. He saw the treaty making process as one that was where the deck was stacked completely in favor of the United States and not at all in favor of the indigenous communities. When these groups sat down to negotiate a treaty, the negotiating table was not level, and that while the United States had the full access to its incredibly well-developed military to enforce its part of the treaty, indigenous communities couldn't and didn't.
You have this quote from him: "These things are like the handle to a jug. The advantages and the power of execution are all on one side." I mean, it is a much more nuanced appreciation of treaties than you would get from somebody who just said it's absurd to make treaties with Indians. That wasn't his tack necessarily.
Yeah, and so this is one of the ways that. Thank you for that quote. Yeah, that's exactly how he thought about it. Parker, this is part of why he was a controversial. This part is part of why he's a controversial character. But he did think about these things in, I think, more complex ways. Parker's ultimately ousted. I think he's, as you said, he is investigated. There's a hearing in the House of Representatives. William Welsh brings charges against Parker of mismanagement and corruption. The House of Representatives Committee on Appropriations hears testimony from dozens of people, contractors, members of the Board of Indian Commissioners, Parker himself, William Welsh, and others, and ultimately finds what they call irregularities, but nothing that would suggest that Parker benefited or profited in any way. Interestingly, and again, I've tried to read every single piece of Parker's writing that I could get my hands on, in archives, in libraries, across the country. This stuff is really spread out. And there's this moment during and immediately after, the charges are in December of 1870. The hearing in the House of Representatives happens early in 1871. Parker does not resign immediately. He stays on for a period of time, and yet the correspondence between members of the Board of Indian Commissioners, William Welsh and Parker, you get the sense that Parker was a beaten man. He loses his willingness to continue fighting against these other men who were working hard to repress his ideas. I think that he comes in to the Office of Indian Affairs on a wave of optimism, and there's this active repression on the part of these other individuals to his ideas, to the point where he really, the tone of his writing is essentially is that of a man who's fatigued and essentially worn out and repressed, basically. Mm. Interestingly, if you read at the same exact time that this is going on, if you look at the congressional record and the debates that are going on, Senate debates over Indian appropriations and other things, the language that other senators are using to describe Native communities and federal policy, it's really incredible. I'm thinking here of Senator Tipton, for example, who was a Republican senator from Nebraska. He said that the reforms of Parker's era of the late 1860s and early 1870s had been a failure. And I actually want to read you this quote because I think the language gives you a sense of exactly what these men were saying. He said, "You say that Quaker policy is a success," and the Quaker policy was essentially the shift in Indian affairs. It was the using Quakers as agents, but it also sort of fits in with larger Reconstruction policy in that it's a melding, it's a public and private way of administering policy, and you see that in Reconstruction at the same time. Part of my larger goal here is to look at the Reconstruction era in a more holistic way, or to look at the ways in which federal Indian affairs and Reconstruction policies are connected. Mm-hmm. Senator Tipton says, "You say that Quaker policy is a success, and the only way to keep the peace is to feed and feed and feed, and let one portion of this country work and work and work and toil in order that your agents may go and feed and feed and feed to save the lives of the rest of the population." Then he goes on to say, "The system is rotten. The system is false. The system can no longer be maintained or endured. The only wise Indian policy," he said, "would be to place Indian people on," and again, these are his words, "reservations guarded around by bayonets, reservations over the limits of which Indians shall not pass, reservations with walls as high as necessary and with pitfalls as deep as necessary."
Concentration camps, essentially. I mean,
sorry, go ahead.
He's proposing concentration camps for Indians.
These are the men with whom Parker was fighting. And furthermore, these were the men who are understood in the literature as humanitarian reformers. Mm-hmm. These are not the military leaders. These are the humanitarian leaders. And this is what they're saying. And if you read further into these Senate debates and other things, this is not an isolated statement. the resonance. I don't want to be presentist in any way, but the resonance of this makers and takers.
I wrote next to it the 47%, but.
So these were the individuals that Parker was up against in this moment, I think that the repression of his ideas. You know, there were several former abolitionists and others who had worked to fight against slavery, who found their way into Indian affairs during Parker's term as commissioner. They were working in the same sorts of ways, and they were confronting these individuals as well. In the aftermath of this hearing, Welsh and the Board of Indian Commissioners successfully destabilized Parker's position, the position of those other reformers. Parker ultimately resigns. He says that he could no longer maintain his position, which had become that of a clerk to a Board of Indian Commissioners. He said that the office of Commissioner of Indian Affairs had become that of clerk of the Board of Indian Commissioners, and that the Board of Indian Commissioners was operating wholly and outside of and independent of the Office of Indian Affairs. And so this is a significant moment, as you say. individuals like this Senator Tipton are those who are advocating the end of treaty making for reasons that are unlike Parker's, I think. Mm-hmm. The fact that it happens at the same time, I think, you know, Parker's ouster and the rider that ends treaty making, I think that they are connected. I think that it's more complex than that, though, and that's what I hope I was able to describe there.
Before we leave Parker, I just want to read the quote that you start the quote that opens the fifth chapter. It's a letter that he wrote to Harriet Converse in 1885. He writes, "I have little or no faith in the American Christian civilization methods of healing the Indians of this country. It has not been honest, pure, or sincere. Black deception, damnable frauds, and persistent oppression has been its characteristics, and its religion today is that the only good Indian is a dead one." Those are pretty stark comments from the former top official of federal Indian policy, only a decade and a half earlier. How do you make sense of the legacy of Parker?
Yeah, I mean, Parker's one of these guys who goes on. I mean, if I were to actually sit down and lay out his full career across the 19th century, I mean, it's incredible. He ends his career living in New York City, working for the New York City Police Department as a clerk, and hanging out with Jacob Riis and Theodore Roosevelt, or interacting with them anyway. Jacob Riis wrote about Parker.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but he maintains a connection to policymaking. I mean, he follows it, he watches it. There are these incredible scrapbooks that he kept during his life. They're actually held at the Newberry Library. I think there are six or eight of them, and it's clear that he clipped or had clipped, there were services that did this, newspaper articles, anything relating to Indian affairs. He would occasionally write a little comment here or there in the margins. And, you know, I think that he sees this this movement from Welsh and the Board of Indian Commissioners into the Friends of the Indian as hugely problematic. This is what he was fighting against. The speed with which allotment envisions assimilation is something that Parker would have had a huge problem with, and did. I mean, I think that that's the context in which he wrote that letter to Harriet Converse. Mm.
So I've taken up a lot of your time already today, but I do want to talk about some of these other reformers that you mentioned in the later chapters of this book. Just as a way of introducing them, I love this story of Alfred B. Meacham, who is Thomas Bland's mentor of sorts when it comes to Indian affairs. Thomas Bland is the focus of one of your chapters here. Meacham is shot four times and partially scalped by a group of frustrated and desperate Modoc men. But after convalescing, he goes right back out on the lecture circuit defending Modoc sovereignty. And Thomas Bland sees one of his speeches and ends up forming the association that you talk about. Talk about these men, these non-native men, like Thomas Bland, like Alfred B. Meacham, in this period after Parker's moments, and what sort of alternatives they proposed.
You know, it's interesting. I wish that I would have spent more time thinking about Alfred Meacham. He's essentially a bridge character for me, because Meacham was involved in the Office of Indian Affairs during Parker's tenure. He was an agent. He was an adherent, a firm adherent to the peace policy and the tenets of the peace policy as Parker had envisioned them earlier. He becomes Bland's, as you say, mentor in a lot of ways. And so for me, he was kind of a bridge character. There are others who have done a lot more and who are doing a lot more really interesting work on Meacham, and Boyd Cawthron at York University writes incredibly interestingly about Alfred Meacham and his work. For Bland's part, Bland was in many ways more radical than Parker was. Bland was a populist, a kind of a proto-populist and then a populist. He was an opponent of banking. He was opponent of monopolies. He feared large combinations of power and wealth. And initially, he was not particularly interested in indigenous issues. It's through Meacham that he becomes interested. And Thomas and his wife Cora, who's an equally if not more interesting person. Cora Bland was a physician in the 1880s when I can't imagine there were almost any other female physicians. She was an editor-in-chief of magazines and newspapers in her own right, and they both became policy advocates and designed this or founded this National Indian Defense Association. They found the organization in 1885, and ultimately used their platform and this newspaper that they published in Washington, D.C. called the Council Fire to fight against the Friends of the Indian and the Indian Rights Association. They're initially sort of allied together. Bland exists in the current literature and the existing literature as a footnote in most people's work. He's an eccentric outlier. He's a troublemaker who never really amounted to much. If you actually go back and look at the size of his organization, it was larger than the Indian Rights Association at the time that that the Dawes Act is passed. He had a lot of supporters. He has part of something that I argue briefly in the book is that there are 137 reels of Indian Rights Association papers on microfilm. Matthew Sniffen, their clerk, kept everything. He was a meticulous organizer. Thomas Bland has no papers anywhere. The only reason that we know what we know about him is from his published work, the books that he published, and his newspaper. I think that the effectiveness with which the Indian Rights Association the effectiveness with which they were able to manipulate the story in the newspapers and the effectiveness of their record keeping has allowed scholars to investigate their side of this debate. And I think that's really shaped the literature. I think that that's why we don't know as much as we do about the National Indian Defense Association as we do the Indian Rights Association. Make sense?
Absolutely.
Well, I was going to say Bland argues firmly against allotment. He has several different kinds of arguments that he makes against allotment, but he champions sovereignty again. He champions treaty rights, and he is unwilling to consider that allotment is in any way a beneficial direction of Indian affairs.
So I've been speaking with Joseph Jenadin Pillawa, author of Crooked Paths to Allotment, The Fight Over Federal Indian Policy After the Civil War, from the University of North Carolina Press. I have a few broader questions I'd like to ask you as we get to the last part of this interview. So, Thomas Bland is ultimately not successful. Allotment passes and wreaks havoc on Indian communal landholding, on Indian sovereignty. Theodore Roosevelt calls it the mighty pulverizing engine that breaks up the tribal mass. Parker as well. I mean, he had some successes, but ultimately he was ousted. Why focus on these characters? What is it about these people and these debates, which, we should admit were ultimately limited, if not totally unsuccessful, in terms of winning the biggest issues of the day? Why are they the subject of study? Why are they so important to reckon with?
I think for a couple of things. They, first of all, I've been interested in historical contingencies. I've been interested in, paths not taken. This idea that it could have gone differently, and also how we might learn from the strategies and arguments made by those who, as you say, who lost. I think that they force us out of some of our out of some of the categorization of the existing literature. It forces us to think differently about some individuals. It forces us to think differently about these time periods. I think that the mid to late 19th century, if you were to ask a scholar of 19th century U.S. history to describe or define the the debates in Indian affairs, they would talk about the military versus humanitarian reformers, essentially.
Right, that's right.
There's a layer of complexity to that that's more reflective of what that time period was like. I think that there are other scholars. Glenda Gilmore comes to mind, Robin Kelly, Maureen Flanagan, who look at individuals who lost, but yet elements of their ideas continue on. I think that that is an important framework here. Ultimately, the work that Parker did and the work that Thomas Blaine did, I think, influence John Collier. And I think that it's about the context. I think that the context of the early Reconstruction period, the context of the early sort of Gilded Age period, the late 1870s and early 1880s, and then the context of the Great Depression are in some ways similar, but in some ways vastly different. And it is during that last context, during the Great Depression, when I think, you know, Collier is able to be successful making some of the same kinds of arguments that both Parker and Bland had made previously.
How do you hope this book might impact how we teach to broader survey courses? And I talked to you a bit in the pre-interview about how when I, you know, I'm a teaching assistant for a second half U.S. history survey courses, and when we get our one day on Indians, it's the inevitable march to allotment and assimilation, and then maybe if they show up again, it's in the Red Power movement, but it's not much other than that. How do you hope that this story might shift the way we teach and talk about this moment in Indian history?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of things there, and I appreciate you asking that question. One of the things that I've tried to do is to highlight some of the connections between the broader reform movements of these different periods and what was going on in Indian affairs. I think there's a couple reasons to do that. Heather Cox Richardson has made this really important, great argument in her book West from Appomattox that if we were to be transported back to the late 19th century, people at that moment wouldn't have separated in their minds things that were going on in the West and things that were going on in the South. It was all of a moment. And that to do so in our scholarship doesn't make sense. If I can even gesture towards reintegrating those things so that we look at the broader picture and how these things were connected. So Reconstruction policies and the early peace policy, for example, how some of those things were connected, I think helps to broaden our understanding and give us a more sophisticated and nuanced understanding of the period. I also think that some of the things that were going on, some of the techniques of reformers in Indian affairs, some of the techniques were tried first in Indian affairs, then made their way into other policy areas and other social reform and things like that. The employing full-time lobbyists, having a communications arm that's writing pamphlets and putting pamphlets in the hands of congressmen and things like that day in and day out. Some of these techniques are then picked up by other kinds of social reformers and activists and used later on. These ideas happened first, though, in the Office of Indian Affairs and in federal policy, federal Indian policy reform. So I think that it helps to make us maybe think a little bit differently about the history of social and political reform in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important, too. The largest point is that to study the 19th century without taking very seriously the indigenous experience is a bankrupt project. I think that kind of summarizes it. You can't understand these periods without understanding how significant and central the indigenous experience and indigenous Indian affairs were. Mm.
So before I let you go, and I just want to say I appreciate that project so much that people like yourself and Kathleen Cahill are doing and other folks are doing in this period. It's so important because you get so many studies of the development of the American state in this moment as if there wasn't a massive federal bureaucracy, really the first of its kind, dealing with people who are treated in sort of law and discourse in a way that that later translates to immigrants and other people in the early 20th century. There are some great studies about that moment in the early 20th century, but it's as if all this debate and development hadn't happened with Indian people in the 19th century. So I think it's a great project that you're engaged in more broadly.
Well, I really appreciate that.
Yeah. So before I let you go, I know this book just came out and you have young kids and there's plenty on your plate and you're a professor and all of that, but I know you're thinking about something next, and I just want to know what's in the pipeline and what you're thinking about tackling next.
Yeah, well, there's two things. I have an edited collection that I've been working on with a friend of mine that is it's currently under an advanced contract, but it's going through the review process right now, called Beyond Two Worlds: Critical Conversations on Language and Power in Native North America. And essentially that takes up this trope, this idea of indigenous people straddling two worlds or trying to exist in two worlds. And it takes it up, questions it in both popular culture and academic scholarship. And we've got, a great volume of essays that will hopefully work its way through the review process quickly. My other project that I'm working on currently is a monograph project tentatively called The Indian's Capital City. I was influenced doing this first book, thinking about the time that Ely Parker spent in Washington, D.C. In the 1840s and 1850s and 1860s, and thinking about what that experience must have been like for an indigenous man, for an indigenous leader, to be in the Capitol as the artwork of the Capitol building itself was being installed. These reliefs and statues and paintings, all of which tell a story and commemorate a story of a conquest completed or the vanishing Indian. And yet, Parker was by no means alone. There were dozens and hundreds of indigenous delegations and visitors coming into the Capitol constantly. So the project looks at the tensions between the commemorative and lived indigenous landscape of the Capitol.
That sounds fascinating. And I know it's probably a long ways off still, but I cannot wait. And I hope to have both books featured on this podcast when they do make their way out. So Joe Jenatan Palawa, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you again, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to an interview with Joseph Jenatan Palawa, author of Crooked Paths to Allotment, The Fight Over Federal Indian Policy After the Civil War, just out from the University of North Carolina Press. You can find us on the web at newbooksandnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all the past interviews free of charge, or on iTunes, where you can download the podcast. We're also on Facebook, where you can leave comments, questions, or suggestions for new books you'd like to hear on this program. Stay tuned for upcoming interviews with Linford Fisher on The Great Indian Awakening, Scott Berg's 38 Nooses, and Jim Poling's Smoke Signals, plus many more in the new year. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening.